kind of weird. As soon as I stepped on board Caroline, I felt like that's why I was here. Me and management never get on. Just, I get on better with listeners than I do with management. And there was laser radio playing out at IBA headquarters. They are rather splendid, aren't they?
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Roger Day.
My parents wrote to Uncle Mac for a request for my birthday. It was 6th or 7th birthday, something like that. And blow me down, he actually played me the record. It was something like Nelly the Elephant or something like that, because I used to drive my parents mad with that. And I was fascinated this man on the radio was mentioning my name.
Well, another mixed bag, and I hope a few requests that I don't recall having included before. If you're settled down and ready, so am I.
And I sort of really wanted to know a lot about radio. I guess that was my first sort of love of radio. And then later on, I guess I would listen to Radio Luxembourg, because my granny used to live with us. Our radio didn't pick it up, but the one in her room did. And when she went to church on a Sunday evening, I illegally, because she didn't let anyone in the room, I used to go in there and tune her radio away from the home service, which is what she listened to Radio Luxembourg, and listen to the chart show, I believe. And that was my first, until I got my own radio, when I used to listen under the bedclothes. People like Tony Hall on Radio Luxembourg, all that fading in and out nonsense that they used to go on. But it was, of course, the only pop radio we used to get, apart from the BBC, light programme occasionally and that sort of thing. So I just love the radio. I used to listen to Journey into Space on the radio, all those great radio plays that used to be on.
Journey into Space. BBC presents Jet Morgan in Operation Luna.
I was always pop music mad, you know. I mean, when I used to travel up to London when I worked at the Metro on Water Board, my nickname was Jukebox Joe, which was one of the characters on the Jack Jackson programme, you know, that he used to have these various silly characters popping in. And because I was always going on about pop music and just reading Record Mirror, New Musical Express and that, I was a bit of an idiot, I suppose, you know, and a real sort of anorak of pop music. And I knew everything about everybody. I used to just scan these papers. I knew about it. And I was known as Jukebox Joe. And my girlfriend at the time, unbeknown to me, wrote up to this thing called Pop the Question with Muriel Young on, was it Southern Television, whatever they were called at the time.
Until the Beatles, I wore cocktail frocks, beautiful silk things with tight waists, like Al McCogan's frocks, you know.
And out of the blue, I got this letter saying they were selected for an audition. Went down to Dover, and they asked me these questions. And, of course, being, this fascination with pop music, I answered them all. And they said, right, you're on the programme. So it was recorded at the Winter Gardens in Margate, October 1965.
Now have you someone who you really love?
And I was on the panel with Chris Andrews. There was another celebrity on the other panel. I can't remember who it was. But, of course, we stormed it, thanks to me, actually, because I knew all the answers. It's ridiculous. I mean, if only I'd concentrated on the other things at school, I'd have been OK. And I won two albums, I think. One was The Fortunes, the other one was a Gene Pitney Hits album, I think. So there you go. And I'd also, at the time before that, been working in the wages department, a place called Pfizer's, who are now famous for developing the Viagra. Everyone knows about them for that, of course, down in Sandwich. And I used to deal with the wage queries on a Friday. And there was a fellow called David Davis who was leaving the engineering department, and I obviously had met him for his pay queries over the years. And when he said, "Oh, I'm leaving," you know, I said, "What are you going to do?" He says, "Oh, I'm going to be the assistant manager at the Dreamland Ballroom in Margate." He saw me on this television programme, and next day I got a phone call from him saying, "Oh, I saw you on the television." He said, "Remember you said you wanted to be a disc jockey?" He said, "Well, Az is leaving." He said, "And I was quite impressed with you on the TV programme. How would you like to come down on Wednesday and start spinning a disc?" So next Wednesday I was down there. Had to have a few beers beforehand because I was so nervous, you know, because when you say you want to do something and when it actually happens, you know, you think, "Oh, my God, I'm going to be found out here."
Wonderful Radio London.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, 10.5 minutes past the hour of 12, and we're in Christmas Day 1965. And if you feel like you're having a kind of a swinging party, why don't you relax, kind of smooch a while?
Nice. Well, it was my 21st birthday, and again, my girlfriend at the time had written to Dave Cash of Radio London for a record for her disc jockey boyfriend, who plays records at Dreamland Ballroom. Bless him, Dave Cash played me this record again, you know, and of course, that my name on the radio. This is fantastic. And they used to do things on shore at the Marquee Club, you know, Radio London Afternoon Out or something, and they were there. He was there that Saturday coming off the ship. And I wanted to go to London to celebrate my birthday, so I went up there and, of course, went to the Marquee to see the Big L afternoon and happened to be in the bar, and guess what? Dave Cash was in there. It was a bit unlike me, because although I, you know, I was on stage at Dreamland, I was quite shy, and I went up to Dave Cash said, oh, hi, you know, I don't know if you remember, you played a record for me on the ship. Well, he probably didn't remember, you know what it's like, but bless him, he did say he remembered. And I said, oh, you know, I'm a disc jockey down there. And I said, I'd love to go on the radio. How do you get a job like yours on the ship? And he says, well, you've got no radio experience, have you? I said, no. He said, well, I'll tell you what, he says, there's some guys who used to be part of the ownership of Radio London, and they're setting up a new radio station, and they've just flown in today, and they're staying at the Hilton. He said, why don't you go and see these guys? He says, they're looking for English people to work on it and go around there. So I did. I went round there, dialed up the room on the old intercom. I said, hello, I'm a disc jockey. I'm interested in working for your radio station. And they said, well, come up. And there were three of them in this room, Ron O'Quinn, the owner, two American owners that were in there. Don Pearson was one of them, that was right. And Bill Vick was the other one. And I sat there, I spoke for about 2 hours. Left them my phone number and that, and I thought, well, nothing much will come of that. And by the time I got home, my dad said to me, because I was still living at home then, my dad said to me, oh, there's a fella called Ron O'Quinn phoned, and he said, you've got the job, could you give him a phone tomorrow? So that was the beginning of the adventure, and he said, well, the ship isn't arrived yet, but when it does, get in there. So I gave a month's notice at Pfizer's, and I went to the chief accountant and said, oh, I'm leaving. And he says, oh, you've got a job at another accountant. I said, not really. I said, have you heard of these offshore stations? And he hadn't, because he was a home service man. And I said, well, I'm joining him as a disc jockey. And I always remember what he said. He says, but what about your pension? I remember thinking, I didn't give a stuff about my pension. This is what I want to do. It was like I'd stabbed him in the heart, the poor boy, though. So there you go. So, but I was the first one they saw. And as a result, Johnny Walker became Johnny Walker, because he was the second one they saw, and he was called Peter D, and they said to him, well, we've already got a D, we can't have a D, so you've got to change your name. And he heard all these American jingles and picked out that wonderful Johnny Walker thing. So if I'd have been the second one in, you might have been interviewing, you know, Johnny Walker now rather than Roger Day.
Johnny Walker,
he's on.
Well, of course, you know, I'd never been out there before. I'd listened to Caroline, I'd listened to Radio London, Radio Such, King Radio and 390. I mean, where I lived in Margate was fantastic, because you've got all the stations down there. So it was Anorak's delight. So we turned up at Harwich, got on this tugboat and went out to the ship, past Radio London and Radio Caroline on the way. So that was a bit of a thrill as well. And out of the mist loomed this Olga Patricia, as it was, with this huge aerial sticking out of it. And we had to leap for our lives on board, which is, you know, because the boats were moving pretty much. And so they threw your bag on and then you. And they sort of sat us down in the mess room, made us a cup of tea and all that. And then showed us around. The studios were still being built. There was technicians all over the place and, you know, running up and down the aerial and that sort of thing. The cabins weren't built either, so we had to actually sleep in the dining room with all these cockroaches running around. It's pretty basic, actually. And there we were, given sleeping bags, and eight fellas all sleeping on the floor of the mess room, that sort of thing, and waiting for them to finish the studio and us to start test transmissions.
Just a preview of the new sound, which will be coming your way on Swinging Radio England, where the action is.
Swinging Radio England.
For the British Isles, Swinging Radio England. Time now is 3:30 on May the 3rd, 1966.
Apparently they chose us because we didn't have the bad habits, as they called, of the other disc jockeys that they'd heard. and they wanted to teach us their way from the beginning, you know. And they did want us to sound like them. They played us all these tapes of these great American radio stations, which I'd never heard before. And if you thought Radio London was good, these guys were even better. You know, all these blokes from Kaysan and that sort of, all these great WFUN, all these great radio stations. Myself and Johnny, we just lapped it up. We just listened. We want to be like that. And one of the first things they said was, all you disc jockeys over here, they always use plurals like hello everybody. And he said, always talk to one person. And that's what we did. It was the best advice ever. And so people say, oh, it sounds like you're talking to me and that sort of thing. We were the equivalent of running at 78 from a 45 record. They wanted us to talk quickly. And, you know, the bass jocks play more music. Wow. And even when we read the news, they wanted it to be fast and slick. And I never got used to reading the news with that format. We had this countdown going behind us, which I always finished the news before the countdown finished. It was ridiculous. I sounded like a Minnie Mouse sometimes, you know. I sounded like somebody on speed. I hear some of those tapes now of those days, and I was known as the fastest talking disc jockey in the West. And I'm surprised anyone could understand what I said. It was, everything was done over music. There was no such thing as dead air. It was either over jingles or the intros of records. It was fantastic, actually. And I think we had a huge young listenership because we were sort of real rock and roll radio. Nobody had ever heard anything like it before. It made even Radio London sound a bit middle of the road.
The bass jock pick it up the week from the Beach Boys, and that's called Good Vibrations. Tell me, my dear, have you read any Good Vibrations lately? Well, I don't think I have on recollection, actually. I've read some papers, though.
Twackle! It's Roger Day on Swinging Radio England.
Boy, we're really swinging here, too. In the fun 50 and slipping down the charts. These little walkabouters, a real smoochy type sound. Another tear falls. So pass that bucket, get ready to catch it, quick.
Given more time, Radio England would have made it, but, you know, they were talk of them banning the stations and that. And that, it didn't make the advertising revenue, so they decided to go Dutch, which made more sense because there was only Veronica going on in Dutch. The news came out and Johnny literally packed his bag and got on the tender, said, I'm off. And the swine went straight round to Caroline and got the job. Whereas me, being me, I thought, well, I was the first voice. I'm going to be the last voice.
20 minutes after 2 o'clock, the Ron O'Quinn radio program on the air until 6 o'clock today, making way for the Roger Day Show.
Then I went back to the clubs, working for Billy Walker at the Uppercut Club in Forest Gate. I sort of kept in touch with Johnny and that sort of thing. And then before the Marina Fancies Act came into being in August of 67, of course, a lot of the stars on there were getting cold feet. And although Caroline was continuing, they didn't want to. So I got a phone call from Terry Bate, who was the wonderful salesman at Caroline. And he said, you know, there's vacancies coming up on the ship. He said, but you've got to be prepared to break the law. He said there's a threat of jail and a fine as well. It was 200 quid, which doesn't sound much now, but in those days it was. He said, and you'll have to live abroad after the 14th of August. He says, does that put you off? He says, no, I've always wanted to work for Caroline. You know, he said, when can you start? I said, when do you want me to start? He said, what about tomorrow? I said, fine. So phoned all my discotheques. I had a good circuit of discotheques. I've made a lot of money out of it. And phoned them up and said, sorry, I'm not going to make it tomorrow. And there I was on the tender going out with Kerry Juby, who had also been taken on board, who later surfaced on Capital Radio. It was about a month before the Marine Offences Act was passed, probably June time, I think, something like that. And went on board Caroline. And it's kind of weird. As soon as I stepped on board Caroline, I felt like that's why I was here. I've never known what it was, but it felt like home, and felt like that was my destiny, if you like. I just felt right from day one. You know, this felt very special indeed.
They just panicked. Broadcasting on 259 metres in the medium wave band, this is the continuing sound of free radio, soon to be the only sound of free radio. This is Caroline, where the time is now 9:30, and that's news time with Jerry Burke.
Israel. The Israeli government has announced that a number of suspected Arab saboteurs...
I was working with these people that were my heroes, you know, like Keith Hampshire, DLT and people like that, because they knew that they were going, and people like Tom Edwards And they were so very kind, actually, particularly Keith Hampshire. We've all known broadcasters that couldn't give a stuff about other people, you know, and it's just me and nobody else. But most of those guys, and Tom Edwards particularly, they were lovely. Tom Edwards had got me the nickname Twiggy because one of the crew looked at me and says, I was sunbathing on deck, and he said, oh, look at him, he's as thin as Twiggy, the model. And the Viking Saga used to come round in the evening with all the tourists. They didn't come on board, but they used to circle round and you know, old people would shout out requests and that sort of thing. I was on air at the time, I think, and they were shouting out, where's Twiggy? And I thought, because Tom Edwards had gone on air and said, oh, we've got, you know, Roger Day coming on later on. One of the crew thinks he's as thin as Twiggy. I think we might call him Twiggy Day. So Twiggy will be on later. And anyway, after one mention, they were all shouting out, where's Twiggy? And my little brain said, this is one mention. This is something that's right. So it became Roger Twiggy Day, thinner record spinner. And that sort of thing, thanks to Tom Edwards. But, yeah, it was very, very strange indeed, because it was sad to see all those guys going. It left us very short staff.
Radio Caroline requires continental and British qualified audio and transmitter engineers. Interviews can be arranged either on the continent or elsewhere. Just write immediately for an interview.
My passport was about to run out, and I thought, well, I don't mind being illegal, but I don't want to be illegal without a passport. Thank you very much. That's going to be big trouble. And I had applied for it, but whether they delayed it because they knew what I was up to. So I had to come off the boat on the 14th of August, which left them a bit in the lurch, to go to Passport House in London and to pick up my passport, which I did. And so I don't think maybe very popular with Johnny and Admiral Robbie Day and all that. They thought I wasn't coming back. That wasn't the situation, you know. So sadly, I wasn't on board when it went illegal, which is a damn nuisance because everyone still talks about that, and I really think I missed out.
Radio Caroline would like to extend its thanks to Mr. Harold Wilson and his Labour government for at last, after over 3.5 years of broadcasting, recognising this...
I flew back to the ship, whereas it used to be an hour from Felixstowe or Harwich. It was from Holland. It took 16 hours on a good day, over 24 hours another on this tender trip. And so I flew out to Holland. And went out to the ship, and it was magical, after all, you know, 16 hours on that that small fishing boat, really, to see what I regarded as my home and be there. But it's a completely different atmosphere after the Mean Offences Act, of course.
With a fun time on Caroline of 14 and a half minutes away from 10, these are the small faces and Ichiku Park.
Well, of course, we didn't get the daily tender. You know, we used to get two tenders a week, and supplies used to run low very quickly. We didn't get fresh milk for a start. We had to drink the long life milk, which is appalling stuff. You know, let's try it. You know, it doesn't taste good on your cornflakes there. We just missed the contact because we didn't see many. Whereas on the tender, there's always people coming out to see how we were, lots of mail coming out. The mail still came, but it was delayed. And there was just us. So it was a bit sort of a cabin fever, you know, because it was just us and nobody else to break the monotony, shall we say.
Well, next time you see the name Dave, be warned, beware. Most of all, you'll be there. Bye-bye now. Look after yourself. I tell you what I'm doing tonight. I'm going over to Frinton for a few beers. So if you see me, find me one, won't you? I'm going to walk across the water.
We were good boys at first. We didn't go back to England because I suppose we were a bit scared. I don't know, I was getting a bit homesick. And I thought, I'll give it a go. And I didn't tell anybody because I thought they might talk me out of it. So I went to Schiphol Airport, a suitcase, and stupidly, I loaded it with a load of mail. Roger Twiggy Day, Radio Caroline, Single 160 in Amsterdam, which was the office there. I should have known better. Anyway, landed at Heathrow. And I was always getting, you know, the customs always, because, you know, where you come from, they stopped you, because I guess coming from Holland, I thought it might have been drugs or something, but I've never touched anything anyway, so don't bother me. So anyway, I got hauled in by this customs officer. Oh, God, Roger, you know, opened the case, and these letters cascaded out, you know, with Roger Twiggy Day, Radio Caroline. I'm done. That's it. And he looked at them, picked up the letters, smiled, put them back in the case, shut the case, and they used to put a cross when they, you know, let you through the customs to say you're okay. And he says, okay, you know, carry on. And I said, what? that's it. You're not going to arrest me. He says, oh, we're not interested in you. He says, the government's stupid for trying to close down the stations. We hate them for it, you know. He says, play us a record on the ship next time you're there, you know. He says, good luck. We all listen, you know. And I said, I don't think I better say where you work when I say that, actually. You might be in trouble with Harold, you know. And so I went there, and I stayed with Mum and Dad and went back the next time, and I went back to the ship and said, it's OK, boys, they're not interested in us. So we all came back.
Harold, the 2nd of March, 1968, over the day. This is Tricky Day, the other day. Just been a one. 7 past the hour.
I was on board on March the 3rd, 1968. One of the worst days of my life, really, because I was just getting ready to do the breakfast show, as per usual, and we used to play continuous music from 5 to 5.30, and I was in there doing the shower and having a shave, the usual thing, getting ready, and a Dutch tug had come alongside, owned by the Weissmuller Company, who owned the company that supplied the tenders. Nothing unusual in that, because they tour around the seas looking for shipwrecks, because they make money out of rescuing boats, and then they get the whole, you know, value of the ship. There were guys on board the tug who'd also been crew members on Caroline, so I knew most of them. And it was the usual thing, you know, what are you idiots doing here, you know? Always come to tow you to Tokyo, I seem to remember one of them said, and I didn't think any more about it. Just carried on getting ready for the programme. Went in the studio, just about to start my programme, run the theme. And the captain came in with the captain of the tug, and he says, you've got to get out the studio. I said, why? He said, because we've got to tow you to Holland. And I said, well, what's going on? You know, I said, can't I just say that we're going to be off air for a while? And he said, no, just clear what you can out of the studio, and we're going to lock the studio up. And that was it. And they cut the anchor chain. I knew that wasn't a good sign, because if we were going back, they would have put it on a marker buoy. And they started towing us to Holland, and everyone else sort of woke up, and I sort of gave them the news that we had been towed. And it was just an awful atmosphere, because we just had this feeling that we weren't coming back after this. You know, we didn't know why it happened. We were crying. You know, everyone was in tears. It was more than a radio station, always has been. And to me, it was what I always wanted to do, and I just thought that was the end of my career, apart from anything else. I thought, nobody else is going to want to know about me now, you know. And that was the end of the bit of the first adventure, shall we say. But to this day, I wish I just flung open that microphone and said, we're in trouble, get somebody to do something about this, you know. But hey, hindsight, great thing, isn't it? I rented a bed city in Archway, I seem to remember, and just didn't know what I was going to do. Had enough cash to see me through a couple of months, and I did send an audition tape to Radio Luxembourg, because somebody had tipped me the wink, one of the promotion guys, that they were looking to revamp their image, because they'd lost out big time to the pirates, obviously, and hadn't recovered. And I didn't know, but they wanted to record hire somebody from Caroline North and somebody from Caroline South. So as I was sort of the best known name, I guess, from Caroline South doing the breakfast show on this station, the response to that breakfast show on Caroline was unbelievable. I mean, the mail we used to get, you would not believe it. You know, people used to send money, presents. We only had to say something on air. We like, you know, like Smarties or something, and there'd be a load of stuff. It was unbelievable. And Tony Prince did the same thing on the North boat, but they took on Tony Prince, Radio Luxembourg. Geoffrey Everett hired us, the big boss there, and they hired me, little old me, to go up to Luxembourg as well. So off we trooped to Luxembourg. I think May I started, so I wasn't out of work for very long before I joined Luxembourg. That's quite a thrill, because I didn't think I stood a chance of joining, you know, the great 208.
Woman, but with her size, she was equal to two. That's a marble tie for Polydor Records. No offence meant, madam. Honestly, and let me see what that is in our charts. It should be very high. Has it gone up? Yeah, it's gone up to a number 11. Considering last week it was number 19, I would say it's destined for much bigger things.
I have to be honest, I hated every minute. Having gone from the freedom of Carol, I know we had to play awful records and that sort of thing, but at least we could say what we liked, and that apart from the plug records, which kept Caroline going, of course, £100 for five plays a day, which kept us going because there were no adverts on going. of course, that turned out why they the bills hadn't been paid, which is why we were towed off by the Weissmullers. But a bit of annoyance, really, because I'm sure if we'd gone on there and said, look, we're in trouble, I wonder if any listeners could send a pound in, you know, it would have saved us. You know, because the money, I'm sure, would have rolled in, but hey, hindsight and that sort of thing. Anyway, no, and we didn't operate our own equipment at Radio Luxembourg. I always thought it was like the BBC with commercials, actually. I mean, it was kind of okay, and a lot of listeners and that sort of thing. I never felt comfortable there, because you had engineers, some of whom didn't even speak English, operating the equipment. I had one who fell asleep on me. I mean, what an insult. I had to go around and nudge him and wake him up, you know, so he could play the next record. So I didn't really take to that. And then out of the blue, the Beach Boys management phoned me up and wanted me to compare their tour of England in 68, December 68. And I asked Luxembourg if I could do that. And they wouldn't give me the time off. So I thought, well, I'm going. I'd rather compare the Beach Boys. I mean, it's a stupid thing to do, I guess. I should have stayed because it was a stepping stone to the Radio 1. But touring with the Beach Boys, I was totally in awe of them. You know, it was just, I didn't get any pictures taken with them. How stupid is that? But they were lovely people. I went off to tour the Beach Boys and was out of work for a while. Went to, back to doing mobile discos for a year, and then saw an advert in Record Mirror, I think it was, said disc jockeys wanted for a European radio station. I thought, oh, that sounds fun. You know, let's have a go at this. Wonder what it is. Sent off a tape and everything. Got a phone call more or less the next day and said, oh, yeah, we know all about you. This rather Maestro Bollier was setting it up. We're setting up an offshore radio station. And there had been a lot of rumours about offshore radio station done by a lot of very strange idiots, shall we say. And I'd met a few of them, and I was just a bit fed up with it. And I said, oh, do me a favour. I said, you know, I've been led down the garden path before. I said, I'll tell you what, send me the airfare and I'll come across and see you. I was a bit blasé about it. And they said, no, we know all about you. You're just the sort of person we want. We know of you from Caroline and everything. And, air ticket arrived, went across to Holland and met them. I still didn't believe it. Stayed at the Grand Hotel in Scheveningen, met up with them, had a good chat about, you know, what they want, their aims were and everything. Went down to the dock in the morning, and there was Mebo 1, as it was then, because it was originally going to be the radio station. Huge tender it was. And we journeyed out, and I still didn't believe it. I thought, well, it's a nice trip, you know. Had a couple of days in Holland. What more can one want? So we journeyed out. It was a misty day. Past Radio Veronica, the Rem Island, which had a radio station and TV station on it as well. And out of the mist came this ship painted psychedelic colours with this huge area. And I remember, I did swear, actually, and that's it. To clean it up, I said, well, blow me down, these silly devils have done it.
220! Radio Nazi.
She's moored some 9 miles off the Dutch coast, and since last Saturday has been transmitting regular pop pirate broadcasts in English and German.
Crikey, I turned to him and I said, you have done it, haven't you? And I went on board, you know, recorded a few things for them to put in the test transmission. I said, well, I can't start immediately, but give me a week and I'll be back. And we discussed money, and that was it. And so I went up, cut my ties over here, and said to my then-wife, said, so I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news, I've got a job on the radio. The bad news is it's in Holland on a ship again. She said, oh, well, I think she knows you've got to do what you've got to do. So packed my bags, severed my disco connections, and again, I built up a nice little circuit, making quite a good money. And journeyed out to radio, and I remember I got a phone call from somebody who said, oh, I've heard you on the test transmissions, you know, when you're starting it. I said, no, it wouldn't be me. I said, that's illegal, isn't it? I wouldn't possibly take that risk again. And they said, well, it does sound like you. I said, no, it's not me. He lied. And then went out and started the test transmissions live from the ship. And that was it. And off we went again.
You're tuned to 186 metres in the medium wave band, 1,607 megacycles. And if you say, well, that's not correct, true, you're listening to the short wave in that case. It's 49 metres, that's 6.210 megacycles. My name? Well, it doesn't matter really, but it's Roger Twiggy Day. Very nice to be talking to you. And could you please...
And if you thought the English offshore stations upset the government... Boy, did Radio North Sea upset the government. I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why. They knew they couldn't deal with Caroline because it had such a huge following. and they were scared to do anything dramatic, I guess. But Radio North Sea was new. I guess they thought they had to do something. We didn't help, actually, because we picked the wrong frequency to start, which did interfere with Coast Guards and that sort of thing. And I did warn them about it. I said, you're too far down. That, apart from that, radios don't go that far. It's going to upset the Coast Guard, which is always what we've avoided. But they were not good people for listening to people that had been there and done it, shall we say. And then to add to that, they did change frequency to a better one. But because they wanted to get the English market, despite my advice that it was a wrong thing to do, they moved across to the English coast. I didn't know why it was a mistake, but I had a feeling that it was a mistake because I thought, we're safe off Holland. Holland likes the offshore stations. They're not going to do anything about it. England, different kettle of fish, still the Labour Party in charge. They're not going to like it. It's like, you know, sticking two fingers up, coming, what are you going to do about it? And I advised them against it. And, of course, as soon as we came over here, they started jamming it, which I did find unbelievable. I mean, I didn't know what they were going to do, but I found that absolutely undemocratic, unbelievable, against freedom of speech, everything. I thought even the communist countries don't do that.
The following is a statement as issued by the directors of Radio North Sea International. Radio North Sea moved to the frequency 1230 kilocycles, 244 metres, because this frequency does not cause any interference to emergency broadcasts or legally authorised stations. However, the British government has accused us of interfering with other stations, although no proof can be found of this.
What we didn't know is that people were actually listening to us despite that. I mean, yes, we have an FM transmitter, but that only got to about Clacton, I think. You know, it didn't go very far. The shortwave transmitters as well. But no, it was a bit, you know, oh dear, you know, it wasn't great. It was not a good atmosphere. You know, it was a job to sort of lift yourself when you went in the studio to do a programme. But then we started getting lots of mail that people were listening, you know, and got feedback. And the mailbags were as big as we were getting on Caroline. People are, you know, were saying, can't believe, you know, there's an offshore station again. And word got around. Of course, there was, you know, News at 10 did a big thing on it. And, of course, that did us a big favour because people that didn't know about us were tuning in. And there's another one. It was Geoffrey Archer did the interview on that. Came onto the ship and said, oh, this is a new offshore station. We were still off Holland at the time. And he actually asked me on there, he says, and will you be going back to England? I said, no, 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 couldn't do that. That's illegal, isn't it? So I get on the plane at Schiphol Airport that night, coming off after 2 weeks on there, and I sat next to Geoffrey Archer on the plane. He says, oh, I'm not going back to England then. He said, don't worry, won't let on. But the News of the World got hold of it. They interviewed me, and that was the first time the police got involved as well, because we'd gone away for a few days in Cheltenham, and I'd never seen so many copies of the News of the World, and there was a picture of me on the front page of the News of the World. Pop pirate flouts the law and comes in, you know, to the country, and all the record companies, you know, are supporting him. This is illegal and blah-de-blah-de-blah. Typical News of the World thing. Despite the fact they said they wouldn't say I was in the... I remember they phoned me up and said, we want to do an interview with me. I said, oh, no, sorry, not interested. They said, well, if we don't give us an interview, we'll tell them the authorities where you live and your real name and everything. I thought, swines. So I had to do the interview, but, of course, they did blurt everything out anyway. So that didn't help. The special branch phoned me up and wanted to interview me. But I did get out of the country very quick when that happened because I didn't fancy going to jail. But whether I would have done, I don't know. But, of course, the station, because of the jamming and the Conservatives got in, we thought they'd lift the jamming, and they didn't. And by then, my time had finished anyway because I went on holiday after the Conservatives won the election, and the Swiss owners had brought in this hotshot American called Larry Tremaine, who they sort of promoted above me because I was the programme director. I'd hired all the staff and everything. I'd formatted the station, which I was very proud of, actually. We were the first radio station to programme album tracks because I thought it needed something different. Yes, we wanted to play all the hits. But by then, albums were outselling singles, and I thought we must put album tracks in the format, which we did. So I'm proud of that. But anyway, Larry Tremaine came over, and he was a disaster, actually. But, of course, me... being the first programme controller, I was obviously he didn't want me around. So I came back from holiday. The classic line is, when's a tender going out tomorrow, Larry? You know, and he says, for you, the tender is never going out. So that was it. I didn't even get a chance to say goodbye. So another sad day, but not quite as sad as Caroline. But yeah, and then after that, very soon after, the jamming continued and Radio North Sea went back to Holland. Then the jamming stopped.
Dames en heren, goedenacht, goeiemorgen, welterusten. Tot ziens.
I mean, in the meantime, I'd been at United Biscuit Network, you know, and doing gigs in colleges and ballrooms up until then. And then my good friend Pete Reeves, because I'd auditioned for Capital Radio. I have to say, I automatically assumed, because I'd just been voted number one disc jockey in a reader's poll in Disco Music Echo, I think it was, despite the fact I hadn't been on air for a while. And I thought, they're bound to hire me, arrogantly, you know, because I've just voted number one in this poll. They didn't choose me. I was gutted. I was about to emigrate, actually. I thought, well, if I've been hanging around for commercial radio and they don't want to know about me, this is, what am I doing here? You know, I must admit, I thought, it hadn't been for me and my friends, you wouldn't be here. How dare you, you know? So anyway, I was about to pack my bags and go. And then Pete Rees, a friend of mine who worked at UBM, phoned up and said, what are you up to? I said, oh, I'm a bit cheesed off, actually. Capital turned me down. I think I'm going elsewhere, you know, America, Canada, see what it's like over there. And he says, well, you know, he says, you remember Philip Birch? Of course I remember Philip Birch, a Radio London boss. He said, well, he's got the franchise, or whatever they called it, license to broadcast to Manchester. He says he's looking for people like you to do it. So I went up there, saw Colin Walters, a programme director, and again, before I went back to London, you know, as a phone call saying, you got the job. And so, you know, there I was, there to do the because he was impressed that I'd just been voted number one disc jockey in the radio poll. So he was impressed, whereas Capital wasn't. And the adventure started in there, and I started at 5 o'clock.
Roger Day.
And it gives me great pleasure for the very first time to say a good Tuesday morning to you. Hit music for the Northwest. We are Piccadilly Radio.
Piccadilly Radio.
Oh, of course. Of course, I chose the first song on Piccadilly, Good Vibrations. And so thanks to the Rotten Turntable, it wowed in. So, and it was rebroadcast on all other stations. So I thought, what an amateur. So there you go. But anyway, it was Good Vibrations with the Beach Boys. And the Mancunian adventure started. And I had some great times. I loved every minute at Piccadilly. It was, despite all the needle time restrictions and we had to do a certain amount of speech, I loved every minute. It was... We were the rebels up there because we had no internet in those days, and the IBA in London hadn't the faintest what we're up to. So we used to, shall we say, we can say now, break a lot of rules, which we did. And we never let it get in the way of being a wonderful radio station. It was like an onshore pirate, really. Well, it would have been with Philip Birch, wasn't it? And very happy times up there. I was naturalised northerner, I always say. It was the best of times.
Jackson 5, Gary Glitter, Four Tops, New Seekers, John Jones, Marvin Gaye.
Hit music for the Northwest.
Piccadilly 261.
I fell out with Colin Walters. Me and management never get on. I get on better with listeners than I do with management. I don't know, he wanted to put me on the overnight show for no particular reason. He was just one of these guys that didn't like things to stay the same. He wanted to change things around. He said, well, you can stay, but you're doing the overnight show. I said, no, I'm not. He could stuff that. And BR&B approached me. I thought they wanted some of the pizzazz at Piccadilly, because Piccadilly used to do a lot of outside broadcasts. We were a pop music station. BR&B I always found a bit dull.
To Lee Phillips on Ward 3, and that's to David. Happy birthday to you, and to David, Claire, and Craig, and Nana Grandad, and also best wishes to Nanny Phillips. This is BRMB, 25 minutes past 7.
You know, if you'd written a book, they interviewed you. And that wasn't my kind of radio. And I thought they hired me to do that. And I remember the first day there, you know, I said, well, OK, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, how do you think we can improve things? I said, well, where's your outside broadcast unit? They said, we haven't got one. Well, don't you do stuff live outside? No, we don't. You know, and and my first programme, they gave me a pile of six books and said, read those and interview the authors. I thought, oh, my God, Roger, you made a big mistake here, son. And that was it. It did improve a bit, I've got to be honest. By the time I left, you know, it was more rock and roll, should we say. But at first I thought, big mistake. But I had no choice, really, and that sort of thing. Then I went briefly to Radio West in Bristol for a year, and that was a bit of a disaster. But I quite enjoyed living in Bristol, lovely place, you know, lots of nice restaurants and that sort of thing. And then got involved with the people who were setting up commercial radio in Kent, which was North Down Radio, which should have been the one broadcasting to West Kent. And they won the licence for that. So we won the licence for it because they upright the application. But it was coincided with, was it Centre Radio in Leicester, going bust. So it was difficult to raise the finances. And so we were forced to amalgamate with the one that had won the licence for Canterbury, which was Invicta Sound. And they kept the name, and North Down Radio sort of just went bye-bye. And there again, that was a disaster to start with, because once again they wanted to be more speech than music, which, as it coincided with the return of Caroline and Laser Radio, wasn't exactly the most sensible thing to do. These people playing records 24 hours a day offshore.
This new service plans to begin broadcasting at 6 a.m. on October the 1st, 1984, and can be heard on a number of frequencies.
Invicta Sound, the song of Kent. Cecilia Garnett was the woman in charge, and she wanted more speech than music, and the figures were appalling. The only people weren't pulling an audience, I think, were me and another guy who were playing mostly music without much speech in it as well, because I remember somebody coming on a tourist studio and said, oh, you know, they were from the IBA. And it was Lady Plowden. All that was wrong with the IBA in those days. I remember she looked at the studio and she says, oh, you've got two turntables. Is it in case one breaks down? I almost collapsed in laughter. I couldn't believe it. I was warned not to say anything, obviously. But that was the standard of the station. And, you know, there was more speech than music, whereas I wanted to be a rock and roll DJ. And she got the boot very quickly, did Cecilia, and Michael Buck came in, and we became a proper radio station. And I remember meeting the guys from Laser Radio, and they said, oh, you're Roger Day. He said, we call you the onshore pirate, you know. And I thought, yes, that's a success, you know, and that sort of thing.
Do you know that all the commercials you hear on this station have been cleared and approved before you hear them?
By law, they must meet the requirements of the IBA Code of Advertising Standards and Practice.
I shall always remember a classic meeting at the IBA in those days. They'll probably deny this ever took place. But they used to have program controllers meetings at the IBA in those days. Nothing unusual in that. And I attended those where we're all, you know, told the new rules and that sort of thing, what we should and shouldn't be doing. But this time it wasn't all the programme controllers. I walked in this room and they're all the managing directors of the southeastern radio stations, Reading, Eddie Blackwell from Essex, and all the other people, and Capital Radio and all that. And I thought, what am I doing here? You know, I'm not usually invited to these sort of things. You know, they did any other business and that. And they said, well, yes, we're here to discuss the offshore radio stations, Caroline and Laser. I thought, oh, that's why I'm here. And they said to me, what can we do about it? And I said, well, I said, do you want to be diplomatic? I'll tell you the truth. And they said, well, I think we'd better tell the truth. I said, well, I feel a bit uneasy because I have a lot of sympathy for these guys because I used to be there, as you know. And I said, there's very little you can do about it. I said, because they're very popular. I said, do you want to know the best thing you can do? I said, hit them the way they need to be hit. I said, by doing what they're doing better. And I think they agreed. You know, they said, well, can't we do this, that, and the other? I said, no, you've got... I said, because people won't forgive you for that. I said, particularly to find out you're meeting to do things about them. I said, you've got to do that. And shortly after that, you know, the needle time restriction went and everything, and they did allow us to be... like they did. So I like to think I was something to do that.
Welcome to Laser 558, where you're never more than a minute away from music, starting now.
There's another great story. Peter Baldwin, lovely man, you know. I used to have regular meetings with him, and usually either before the pub or after the pub. and went back to his office, and he said, because you know, he's like an old army type, you know, a lovely gentleman. He said, "What do you think of this this laser radio?" I thought, "Well, should I say what I think he wants me to say, or should I say what I really feel?" I said, "Actually, it's fantastic, isn't it?" I said, "I really, this reminds me of Radio England that I was on. You know, it was, I said, there's nothing new. We were doing that back in 66. And he leaned back on his chair and he said, "Yes," he says. And he punched the button on his radio, and there was laser radio playing out at IBA headquarters. He said, "They are rather splendid, aren't they?" And I said, "Yeah, why don't you let us do that?" And of course, soon afterwards, we were let rip to do that. So bless him.
Laser, 558.
Invicta was one of the first to be amalgamated with Southern Sound, wasn't it? Southern Radio, whatever they called themselves. Out of Southampton, which is a bit of a surprise because they weren't successful. Invicta by then was cooking. It was making, we had the highest audience increase, highest audience. The money was rolling in. It was fantastic. It was a great run, making loads of profit, whereas Southern, lowest audience figures, weren't making much money. In a amalgamation, I thought that we would be the boss kings. It didn't turn out that way. I just don't know why. So Roy McLeod and his team took over, and of course they came in at Invicta. And I shall always remember the meeting before it was literally the day before Christmas, and they put a plan of staff up there. My name wasn't on there, and I was the programme director. And I remember going to Roy McLeod afterwards, and I said, "Look, let's be honest." I said, "I'm out, aren't I?" He says, "Oh no, we can't afford to." Replace somebody with your experience. I thought, yeah, heard that before. Just a kiss of death, that is, a vote of confidence. I said, "Look, be honest with me." I said, "What's the deal? You know, I'm going." I said, "Let me do it first." I said, "Well, I know it's Christmas coming up." I said, "But I'd rather know before there's a rush for jobs elsewhere." He said, "Oh, no. And of course, right after Christmas, first meeting, he turns up with the accountant. I thought, oh, this is it. And it's bye-bye, Roger. I was very sad because I'd always wanted to set up and run a station in Kent, my home county. And yes, I did that. And I'm very proud of what we did there. One of the best sounding radio stations that this country's ever known. I know it sounds like I'm blowing my own trumpet, but it was fantastic. We kicked butt, as we say, you know. And a lot of people, you know, thought, yeah, this is good. Then I went to work for Mike Powell at various stations that he had around, particularly Pirate FM in Cornwall. Had to work there with that name, didn't I? And that was good as well. Had some fun times down there, but it was too far away from the family. So came back, worked for them in Guildford. Then some very happy times for Saga. I wasn't there when it started. I wish I had been. And worked for them. And I loved every minute there. It was fantastic. It was just right for me because it was targeting over 50s, you know. And hey, I was over 50 by then.
Saga 105.7 FM.
And I thought the format was wonderful. There was fantastic people there. And some of the happiest times on the radio. And I loved Birmingham. Yeah, good times. I was very sad when that all went. But I did... It coincided with being offered the evening show at the BBC across the south, so it sort of dulled the pain a little, shall we say, and had some good times until there were cutbacks there as well, and they did local radio nationally, shall we say. Enough said about that.
It's such a well-known number, but it was never a hit. Outrageous! What were you buying instead of that? Oh, you did buy it. That's all right. You'll let off. That wasn't a hit, nor was Surf City.
I would
City,
like to be remembered as the man who thought the music was more important than anything else, and that radio was there to be entertainment. And I mean, I hate what radio has become. Dull, boring, predictable. Not all, you know, but there's an awful lot of dross out there. And it to a certain extent... What we fought for back in the 60s needs fighting for again, you know, to reinvent, because the listeners are fed up with it. You only have to see the websites that they don't like the repetition of the music. They really don't like it, and they certainly don't like the threes in a row, and that they want a bit of personality, because anyone can play, you know, the favourite songs on an iPod. So what difference does it make when you play your favourite music? It's the bits in between that count. to me, a good broadcast is somebody that at the end of a broadcast, you've said something, might have moved them or made them laugh or made them relate to their lives they're living. And there's very little of that on the radio today, and shame on those that have allowed that to happen. I really would like to see more local radio as well. There's too much networking going on, and I think that's a tragedy. I'm probably too outspoken. I don't hide my feelings and never have. I tell it the way it is, which is why I probably get on with listeners more than management. Not many managers like being told if they're doing things wrong. I must admit, when I was in management, I didn't mind people telling me things because I thought, I've never thought I got everything right. And you learn from other people. I think you've got to do that. Yeah, perhaps more diplomacy would have... diplomacy's never been my best feature. I shoot from the hip. Mistake was leaving Luxembourg. Shouldn't have done that. That would have led perhaps to national radio. And also, I could have been the first boss at Capital Radio, because it was just after Radio North Sea, and these two guys came to see me at the flat in Surbiton where we were. I thought they were a couple of idiots, actually, to be quite frank. They said they wanted to apply for the licence for London, which was now in the air, you know, and they wanted me to be the programme advisor. And I was a bit cool with them, to say the least, because once again, I'd been approached by a lot of time wasters, and I wanted to earn money, you know, and I just wasn't convinced. One of them was the son of the dentist who was the original shareholder at Capital Radio. And I've still got a letter there that says Capital Radio wants to hire you and this sort of thing. And I basically told them to get stuffed. So, yeah, quite. I couldn't. That's a bit of a regret, I've got to be honest about that. But I've been blessed. I've had wonderful times. The listeners are fantastic. The wonderful thing now with the internet is, whereas before, like when you got the axe from Piccadilly, from BRMB, I always thought it was unfair on listeners because quite often you weren't allowed to do a last show, and all of a sudden there was this man they liked or woman that they liked, and they weren't there anymore. And I thought that's unfair. But of course now with the internet, the media we've got now, they can follow you wherever you are. And I mean, I get people now, as I say, have been listening to me since 66. And that sort of thing. And they're so lovely. And, you know, because I run this internet radio station now. And they support it financially as well. I couldn't have done it without them, you know. And I mean, I've had moments when I... Bad times, obviously, when I haven't liked what I was doing. Early days of BRMB and things like that, when it looked like it was, you know, it wasn't going well and the finances were bad. And I thought, it's time, you know, you've had your fun, Rog, get out, get a proper job and that sort of thing. I mean, fortunately... Those around me, the family, have always taught me out of it. And, you know, here I am still doing it. But it's the listeners that have kept me doing it and still do. You know, I always say, you know, I'll give up when listeners stop liking what I do. Thank God and touch wood, that hasn't happened yet. And hopefully I'll be doing it till, you know, I put in that wooden box. Because I've no intention of retiring. I feel as excited as I did back in 1966. Hopefully not as nervous. I feel at home. I feel more at home in a radio studio than I do anywhere else. To me, it's just what I was put on this earth to do.